provided the last one. It's a tendency that fits with my account of the Harrisons agreeing to house an 18-year-old student they had never met, not because they owed his family a favor, but because they had a decade-long history of exchanging holiday cards with them. The process of reciprocal exchange had prompted the Harrisons' assent by creating a relationship rather than an unmet obligation. The Aarons and their co-workers helped explain this kind of willing assent by showing how extended reciprocal exchanges bind the transactors together. They did so by employing a particularly unifying type of reciprocal exchange strong enough to unify people into love with each other. Personal self-disclosure. The procedure was not complicated. In pairs, participants took turns reading questions to their partner, who would answer and who would then receive their partner's answer to the same item. Advancing through the 36 questions required participants to disclose progressively more personal information about themselves and, in turn, to learn more personal information about their partner. An early question would be, "What would constitute a perfect day for you?" Whereas later in the sequence, a question would be, "What do you value most in a friendship?" And near the end of the list, a question would be, "Of all the people in your family, whose death would be the most disturbing?" Relationships deepened beyond all expectations. The procedure generated feelings of emotional closeness and interpersonal unity that are unparalleled within a 45-minute span, especially among complete strangers in an emotionally sterile laboratory setting. Moreover, the outcome was no chance occurrence. According to an interview with Elaine Aaron, hundreds of studies using the method have since confirmed the effect, and some participants have even gotten married as a result. In that same interview, Dr. Aaron described two aspects of the procedure that she felt are key to its effectiveness. First, the items escalate in personal disclosure. Thus, when responding, participants increasingly open themselves up to one another in a trusting way, representative of tightly bonded pairs. Second, and in keeping with the overarching theme of this chapter, participants do so by acting together, that is, in a coordinated back-and-forth fashion, making the interaction inherently and continuously synchronous. Co-creation. Long before wilderness preservation became a value among many Americans, a man named Aldo Leopold was championing the cause. Principally during the 1930s and 1940s, when he held the first ever professorship of wildlife management in the United States at the University of Wisconsin, he developed a distinctive ethical approach to the topic. As detailed in his best-selling book, A Sand County Almanac, it challenged the dominant model of environmental conservation, in which natural ecologies were to be managed for the purpose of human usage. It advocated instead for an alternative based on the right of all plant and animal species to existence in their natural state whenever possible. Possessed of such a clear and heartfelt position, he was more than surprised one day to find himself, axe in hand, behaving in contradiction of it, by cutting down a red birch tree on his property so that one of his white pines could get more light and space to grow. Why, he wondered, would he act to favor the pine over the birch that, according to his avowed ethic, had as much right to exist naturally as any tree on his land? Perplexed, Leopold searched his mind for the logic behind his bias, and, in considering various differences between the two types of trees that might account for the preference, encountered only one he was convinced was a primary factor. It was one that had nothing to do with logic but was entirely founded on feelings. Well, first of all, I planted the pine with my shovel, whereas the birch crawled in under the fence and planted itself. My bias is thus, to some extent, paternal. Leopold was not unique in feeling a special affinity for something he had a hand in creating. It's a common human occurrence. For example, in what researchers have termed the IKEA effect, people who have built items themselves come to see their amateurish creations as similar in value to experts' creations. As suits our current focus on the effects of acting together, it is worth inquiring into an additional pair of possibilities. Would people who had a hand in creating something hand in hand with another come to feel a special affinity not only for their creation but also for their co-creator? What's more, might this exceptional affinity stem from a feeling of unity with the other that's detectable in the characteristic consequences of elevated liking and self-sacrificial support for the partner? Let's seek to answer those questions by resolving a prior one. Why would I begin this section on co-creation with Aldo Leopold's description of the effect of planting of a pine by himself? It's simply that, as I am certain he would agree, he was no lone actor in the process. He was a co-creator, with nature, of the mature pine he once put in the ground as a sapling. The intriguing possibility that arises is whether, as a result of acting together with Mother Nature, he came to feel more merged with her, and, as a consequence, even more enamored and respectful of his partner in the collaboration. If that were so, we'd have an indication that co-creation can be a route to unification. Regrettably, Mr. Leopold has not been available for questioning on the possibility since 1948, but I am confident of the answer. A portion of that confidence comes from the results of a study I helped conduct to investigate the effects of managers' degree of personal involvement in the creation of a work product. I'd expected that the more involvement managers felt they'd had in generating the final product in concert with an employee, the higher they would rate its quality, which is what we found. Managers led to believe that they'd had a large role in developing the end product, an ad for a new wristwatch, rated the ad 50% more favorably than did managers led to believe they'd had little developmental involvement, even though the final ad they saw was identical in all cases. In addition, we found that the managers with the greatest perceived involvement rated themselves more responsible for the ad's quality in terms of their much greater perceived managerial control over their employee, which I'd also expected. But I didn't expect a third finding at all. The more the managers attributed the success of the project to themselves, the more they also attributed it to the ability of their employee. I recall, data table in hand, experiencing a moment of surprise. Perhaps not as striking as Leopold's axe-in-hand moment, but a moment of surprise nonetheless. How could supervisors with greater perceived involvement in the development of a work product see themselves and a single co-worker on the project as each more responsible for its successful final form? Only 100% of personal responsibility can be distributed, right? And if one party's perceived personal contribution goes up, by simple logic, the work partners should go down, not up. I just didn't get it at the time, but now I think I do. If co-creation causes at least a temporary merging of identities, then what applies to one partner also applies to the other, distributional logic notwithstanding. Asking for advice is good advice. Co-creation doesn't only reduce the problem of getting supervisors to give more credit to employees who've worked productively on a project. It can lessen a host of other traditionally hard-to-diminish difficulties. Children below the age of 6 or 7 are typically selfish when it comes to sharing rewards, rarely distributing them equally with playmates, unless they have obtained those rewards through a collaborative effort with a playmate, whereupon even 3-year-olds share equally the majority of the time. In the standard classroom, students tend to coalesce along racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines, finding friends and helpmates mainly within their own groups. However, this pattern declines significantly after they've engaged co-creatively with students from the other groups within cooperative learning exercises, in which each student has to teach a portion of the information to the others so that they can all get a good score. Companies struggle to get consumers to feel bonded with and therefore loyal to their brands. It's a battle they've been winning by inviting current and prospective customers to co-create with them novel or updated products and services, most often by providing the company with information as to desirable features. However, within such marketing partnerships, consumer input must be framed as advice to the company, not as opinions about or expectations for the company. The differential phrasing might seem minor, but it is critical to achieving the company's unitization goal. Providing advice puts a person in a merging state of mind, which stimulates a linking of one's own identity with another party's. Providing an opinion or expectation, on the other hand, puts a person in an introspective state of mind, which involves focusing on oneself. These only slightly different forms of consumer feedback and the nonetheless vitally different merging versus separating mindsets they produce can have a significant impact on consumer engagement with a brand. That's what happened to a group of online survey takers from around the United States, shown a description of the business plan for a new fast casual restaurant, Splash, that hoped to distinguish itself from competitors through the healthfulness of its menu items. After reading the description, all the survey participants were asked for feedback, but some were asked for any advice they might have regarding the restaurant, whereas others were asked either for any opinions or expectations they might have. Finally, they indicated how likely they'd be to patronize a Splash restaurant. Those participants who provided advice reported wanting to eat at a Splash significantly more than participants who provided either of the other sorts of feedback. And just as we would expect if giving advice is indeed a mechanism of unitization, the increased desire to support the restaurant came from feeling more linked with the brand. One more finding from the survey clinches the unitization case for me. The participants rated all three types of feedback as equally helpful to the restaurateurs. So it wasn't that those who gave advice felt connected with the brand because they thought they had aided it more. Instead, having to give advice put participants in a togetherness state of mind rather than a separateness state of mind just before they had to reflect on what they would say about the brand. A finding that, I have to admit, pleases me because it implicates the persuasive character of the psychological process acting on those advice-giving participants. This set of results also clinches for me the wisdom and the ethicality, if done in an authentic search for useful information, of asking for advice in face-to-face interactions with friends, colleagues, and customers. It should even prove effective in our interactions with superiors. Of course, it is reasonable and rational to worry about a potential downside, that by asking a boss for advice, you might come off as incompetent or dependent or insecure. While I see the logic of such a concern, I also see it as mistaken because, as the study of supervisors' estimation of collaborators' contributions indicated, the effects of co-creation are not well captured by reason, rationality, or logic. But they are exceedingly well captured by a particular socially promotive feeling in the situation, the highly beneficial for you state of togetherness. The novelist, Saul Bellow, once observed, "When we ask for advice, we are usually looking for an accomplice." I'd only add, on the basis of scientific evidence, that if we get that advice, we usually get that accomplice. And what better abettor to have on a project than someone in charge? Getting together. It's time to look back at, and more dauntingly, look past what we've seen as the most favorable consequences of being together and acting together. We learn, for instance, that by installing one or another of those two unitizing experiences in people persuasively, we can arrange to solidify support from a company's shareholders as well as its customers, and to help ensure that soldiers will stand and fight rather than flee in wartime. In addition, we found that we can use those same two unitizing experiences to arrange for playmates, classmates, and workmates to like, help, and cooperate with one another. For nearly any parent to fill out a long survey with no financial compensation. And even for love to emerge in a lab. But here's an unanswered question. Might it be possible to apply the lessons from these arenas to much larger stages, such as those involving age-old international enmities, violent religious clashes, and simmering racial antagonisms? Could those lessons from what we know about being together and acting together increase our chance of getting together as a species? That's a tough question to answer, in large part because of the many complications inherent in such matters. Still, even on these fraught fields, I believe that procedures that establish a persuasive feeling of unity establish a context for desirable change. Moreover, provided that both parties share the feeling, the desirable change is likely to be mutual, reducing the probability that either party will feel exploited, deepening a sense of togetherness, and raising the likelihood of continued positive interaction. Although this idea sounds hopeful in hand-waving theory, it would be naive, owing to the attendant procedural and cultural complications, to presume that the theory would work out smoothly in practice. The specifics of the unitizing procedures would have to be optimally designed and enacted with those complexities in mind, something with which the experts on the issues would surely agree, and which might be the worthy subject of an entire follow-up book. Needless to say, I'd certainly welcome those experts' opinions. Make that advice in that regard. Chapter 13. Ethical Use. A Pre-Persuasive Consideration. A central assertion of this book is that our choice of what to say or do immediately before making an appeal significantly affects its persuasive success. But there's a related choice that occurs even before that one. It is whether, on ethical grounds, to try to attain success in such a way. I am not alone in considering this an important part of the equation, as ethical questions surface regularly whenever I convey information on the topic of effective persuasion. However, there is one specific type of question, as stated by one specific type of recipient, that is especially relevant to this book and the topic of persuasion. In revealing the secrets of social influence, am I doing more harm than good by giving certain unethical practitioners the means to trick consumers into buying even more of whatever they might be peddling? The individuals most likely to pose the question to me have been representatives of the media. Although the overall experience was mostly a blur, I do recall a steady diet of such media questioning during the only book tour I've ever agreed to undertake. The circuit traversed a marathon course of 10 cities in 10 days, each of which included multiple media interviews led by print journalists or radio or TV hosts, who had little information about me and, in the bulk of instances, had not read the book. The exchanges varied in a few ways. Some took place numbingly early in the morning, others throughout the day, some lasted only a few minutes, others as long as an hour. Some were one-on-one interviews, others were led by a pair of co-hosts, and some included audience call-in questions, often of the uncomfortably personal and professionally unanswerable variety. So, Doctor of Influence, how do I get my jackass brother-in-law to stop borrowing my tools and then forgetting to return them? And besides, I think he's running around on my sister. What do I do about that? But one feature didn't vary much. At some point, the interviewer would raise the more harm than good idea, asking me to respond to the possibility that my book was doing society a disservice by showing devious merchandisers how to use psychology to bamboozle us. It was usually possible to counter the concern by pointing to a pair of aspects of the book that the interviewers, not having read it, did not know. First, it was written for consumers, to give them the information necessary to recognize and reject unwanted or unfair influence attempts. Second, much of the information came from the practitioners. More often than not, primarily in their training programs, they were informing me of which procedures reliably got consumers to say yes. Although they might not have appreciated the psychological factors that caused their practices to work, the majority of influence professionals knew quite well what did work for them. Consequently, I argued, the material in my book wasn't offering any new techniques for practitioners to adopt. Instead, it was balancing the equation by providing information to consumers about the tactics routinely employed on them. With this current book, though, those two responses aren't available to me. The conclusions drawn here have been principally about how to harness influence rather than deflect it. So the consumer defense doesn't apply. What's more, the practice of persuasion, as described here, isn't widely employed within the community of influence professionals. I can't make the claim this time that I'm just revealing tactics already known to the preponderance of practitioners. Only a rarefied few understand the process of persuasion well enough to commission them systematically on their behalf. It's therefore a legitimate concern that publication of the information might enlighten certain unethical organizations about how to trick people into assent more effectively. This possibility becomes even more worrisome with the realization that many persuasive processes operate unconsciously and hence go unrecognized. As a result, whenever addressing commercial organizations regarding persuasive practices, I've had to change direction and revert to a traditional argument against deceptive business tactics. It goes as follows. Although such tactics might increase profit in the short run, once exposed, they will produce unacceptably high costs, mostly in the form of severe damage to the company's reputation and to subsequent trust and future earnings. For a while, I thought this argument quite good for two reasons. First, it makes its case on the dimension of economic vitality, which business leaders have to take into account to maintain growth and, indeed, survival. That strikes me as a more motivating rationale for recommended action in commercial environments than finger-wagging about a lack of virtue. Accordingly, I'm sure there will never be a law against shouting ethics in a crowded boardroom, because unlike fire in a crowded theater, the term doesn't possess enough mobilizing force there to spur urgent movement. That's not to say that, as a group, business people wouldn't prefer to be ethical. All else being equal, most would unhesitatingly choose the high road. But except in hypothetical situations, all else is never equal. And we often see that factors with more motivational punch, sales quotas, financial status reports, competitive concerns, career advancements, prevail over higher-minded choices in commercial decisions. Besides, acting to promote corporate profitability through sometimes less than ethical means can be seen as honorable by leaders who feel a moral responsibility to enhance and ensure the economic well-being of their employees. When viewed through this admittedly tilted lens, A decision to stretch the truth to benefit corporate fiscal stability could be judged to be the ethically proper one. Therefore, I assured myself, any argument pointing out how deceptive practices actually threaten the bottom line would be compelling. The second reason I thought the case for reputational damage would be telling to business decision makers is that the evidence supporting it is solid. The size of financial loss from reputational consequences can be substantial, as large economic injury has been shown to flow from the reputational impact of false advertising, deceptive bidding practices, and financial misrepresentations. For example, a 2005 study of 585 firms subjected to U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, enforcement proceedings for financial misrepresentation found that, on average, companies lost 41% of their market value after the misconduct was made public, and that nearly two-thirds of the loss stemmed from reputational harm. Indeed, 80% of Americans stated that their perception of the ethicality of a particular company's business practices has a direct effect on their decisions to purchase its goods and services. Such effects received more recent validation in 2015, when, shortly after Volkswagen's diesel emissions trickery became known, its sales dropped to 1/16th of the industry average. It suffered the largest annual loss in company history, and its reputation among vehicle owners went from 70% favorable to 80% not favorable. Plus, the damage is singularly difficult to undo. Research indicates that a disreputable company attempting to recover lost trust would need to demonstrate its newfound integrity consistently and on many occasions to convince the wary that the firm's values had changed. Such a recovery process could take years, by which time the company's former customers and clients are likely to have established links to rivals' products and services. Satisfied that this strong economic argument would convince business leaders to avoid devious practices, I was content to describe the workings of persuasive influence strategies to them, provided that I invariably made the reputational disaster case as well. Then I read the results of a pair of global surveys that forced me to change my thinking. They revealed that senior business leaders are very much aware of the evidence in support of the reputation-based case I was making, but that uncomfortably large numbers of them are willing to undertake misconduct anyway. Despite understanding the risks, close to half of high-ranking executives reported they would act unethically to get or retain business. In addition, sales and marketing staffers, who were most likely to endorse ethically dubious conduct to secure a win, were least likely to be questioned about it by the company. Finally, employees of these firms saw few actions taken at the top, either to prevent profit-enhancing ethical violations or to punish those involved after the fact. As a consequence, the amount of unethical activity on the part of commercial organizations remains distressingly high. Apparently, many senior leaders are cognizant of the potentially ruinous consequences of discovered ethical misconduct, but are not deterred by them. That seems clear. What's not is why not. It's conceivable that these leaders are engaging in a form of psychological compartmentalization, mentally walling off their knowledge of the reputational risks of wrongdoing from their active participation in or tacit permission of it. But I don't think so. Those at the highest levels of an organization don't get to their prominent positions by systematically ignoring clear and present dangers. I'd favor a simpler explanation. They just don't expect to get caught. They wouldn't engage in misconduct if they thought it would become visible to penalty-wielding customers, clients, and regulators. This explanation fits with findings from studies of crime deterrence, demonstrating that individuals who commit violations carrying significant negative consequences do not believe they will be caught. Otherwise, they would be unlikely to undertake the punishable activities in the first place. The dilemma is easy to see. On the one hand, many business leaders would likely be dissuaded from unethical activity by alarming economic considerations. On the other hand, the cautionary economic argument against such activity has failed to reduce misconduct because it involves an expectation of discovery, which most perpetrators surely would not possess when deciding to act. How can we extricate ourselves from the horns of this dilemma? One possibility would be to acknowledge business leaders' understandable tendencies to weigh economic factors heavily in business decisions, and then to document several onerous financial penalties that flow from unethical conduct, even if it goes undetected by the public. Along with my colleagues Jessica Lee and Adriana Samper, I've recently conducted research to provide evidence of such expenses that come from the responses of individuals inside, not outside, the organization. We've also tried to detail how these harmful costs can develop and how they can slip undiagnosed under the radar of most business systems. The triple tumor structure of organizational dishonesty. Do not seek dishonest gains. Dishonest gains are losses. Hesiod. Here's what we've attempted to show. An organization that regularly approves, encourages, or allows the use of deceitful tactics in its external dealings with customers, clients, stockholders, suppliers, distributors, regulators, and so on, will experience a nasty set of internal consequences that are akin to tumors. Not only will they become malignant, growing, spreading, and eating progressively at the organization's health and vigor, they will be difficult to trace and identify via typical accounting methods as the true causes of inferior profitability. Thus, they might easily lead to expensive, misguided efforts that fail to target the genuine culprits of the dysfunction. Three features of a commercial organization known to ravage its health are poor employee performance, high employee turnover, and prevalent employee fraud and malfeasance. The costs of each can be staggering. Our claim is that organizations possessing an unethical work culture, in which employees participate in or simply observe regular wrongdoing, will be beset by the three outcomes. We are not assigning these outcomes to localized or infrequent ethical infractions, but rather to a dominant organizational culture that permits or promotes dishonest business practices. Inferior work performance is probably the biggest saboteur of profitability. Let's begin with it. Poor employee performance. Places of work can be stressful. We all know it. What we might not appreciate, though, is how costly that stress can be. One recent analysis found the toll to be heavy on both personal and economic dimensions, as various kinds of occupational stress, when combined, led annually to about 120,000 deaths and $200 billion in additional health care expenses in the United States alone, where employers bear much of the financial burden. However, there is yet another type of cost-carrying workplace stress that went unexamined in this analysis, but is related directly to the issue of organizational misconduct. We can call it moral stress, and it comes from a conflict between an employee's ethical values and the perceived ethical values of the organization. In the case of employee performance, this kind of stress can be even more harmful than other stressors known to be highly damaging. For example, a study of customer service agents in a financial service call center compared moral stress with other forms of stress there, including problems with difficult customers, lack of support from supervisors and/or coworkers, conflicting task demands, and dead-end job descriptions. Only moral stress predicted both of two performance-degrading outcomes: employee fatigue, low emotional spirit and physical energy, and job burnout, loss of enthusiasm for and interest in one's work. These two outcomes weren't chosen for study offhandedly by the researchers. Each is a serious managerial problem by itself. Combined, they're a managerial nightmare, robbing workers of the vigor, desire, and capacity to do their jobs well. Might it be that in creating an unethical work environment, an organization unknowingly creates that nightmare for itself? Might an unethical work environment produce lower performance in workers who didn't behave unethically themselves, but merely observe such behavior among their fellow workers? To find out, we arranged an experimental situation that allowed us to test the effects of dishonest workplace activity, not only on task performance, but on our other specified organizational tumors. We invited university business students to sit at a computer networked to those of team members at various other universities. Their team would compete, they were told, on problem-solving tasks against other teams from around the country. If their team did well on the first task, it would be given a competitive advantage over the other teams on the next group task. Finally, they were told that because of some technology issues with only their computer, they wouldn't be able to send information to their teammates, although they would be able to see their teammates' online interactions with one another. After the team members perform the first problem-solving task, they learned from their team leader that the team had gotten only 67% of the answers correct. They also learned that, nonetheless, this leader intended to report 80% correct answers to the researcher to improve the group's perceived performance. Because, as the team leader confided, there was no way that cheating could be discovered by the researcher. None of the other team members stated any objection. Of course, this sequence of events was something we manufactured for our study's participants. The information they got from their team leader and team members was programmed by us to appear on their computer screens as we designed it. The same was true for a second set of our participants, who received identical information with one crucial difference. They saw their team leader report, intending to submit the group 67% score honestly to the researcher. And here again, they witnessed none of the other team members stating any objection. At this point, then, half of our participants had been made to be part of a work unit that approved of and engaged in deceit to obtain a competitive advantage, whereas the other half of our participants had not. Thus, we were poised to learn how the two experiences affected the costly consequences we had predicted. First came an examination of subsequent work-relevant performance. All participants were informed that the next task would be an individual one, in which each would read about a business situation and then answer critical reasoning questions associated with it. We took the business situation and its related questions from a well-validated test of business intelligence to ensure that performance on it would involve the kinds of judgments that affect business success. The ensuing data showed dramatic differences. Those participants whose work team had previously been deceptive scored 20% lower on the test than our other participants. Another finding gave us an indication of why the first group performed so poorly. After working on the business problem for a while, the members just stopped, significantly sooner than the other participants, suggesting they didn't have the same energy or motivation to continue. Although these results were encouraging for at least one aspect of our thinking, we could imagine hearing the nays of a frustrating collection of naysayers declaring themselves unconvinced because evidence on workplace issues coming from 1, a laboratory experiment, 2, on university students who, 3, encountered an artificially constructed unethical environment is inadequate. In truth, The most frustrating feature to us of these imagined critics was that they had a point. We recognized that to confirm that our data patterns applied to real-life employment situations, we needed to find out from a sample of workers how ethics-relevant workplace factors operated on them. We set out to do so by conducting a national survey of adults who had been at their current or most recent job for an average of 3 years. The survey contained a lot of questions about these individuals and the places they worked. But for our current focus, three types of items carried special weight. Those asking them to rate the ethical climate of the organization as set by its managers and leaders, the amount of stress they felt there, and the quality of their work performance. When we analyzed their responses, we found results that fit with and even exceeded the findings of our university laboratory experiment. According to their reports, first, the more unethical the climate, the poorer the worker's job performance. Second, the more unethical the climate, the more stress they felt at work. And third, that particular stress caused their poor performance. With this evidence in hand, when making an economically centered pitch to business leaders against unethical activities, we thought we had the makings of strike one. Employee turnover. For business leaders, there's one good feature of employee turnover costs. They can be assessed fairly precisely. But that's where the good news ends. Depending on the type of employee lost in the process, charges to the bottom line range from large to eye-wateringly large. Estimates of direct expenses associated with turnover, severance pay, recruitment, hiring, and training of the replacement can extend from 50% of the employee's annual compensation package for lower-level positions to over 200% of the total package for executive-level positions. These costs spiral even higher when indirect hits are taken into account. Loss of institutional memory, sales and productivity disruptions, lowered morale among remaining team members. But to get a conservative estimate of voluntary turnover costs, let's assume that on average, the combined direct and indirect expenses were equal to just 1 year's total remuneration. Voluntary turnover rates in the United States are now above 15% per year. But for the average mid-sized firm of 1,000 employees, even if only 10% of workers, who averaged $40,000 in total salary and benefits annually, walked out, they would take with them $4 million every year in turnover costs. How is this economic toll related to unethical work practices? We thought it would be through the moral stress experienced by employees whose personal values conflicted with regular wrongdoing. One reason an honest person would want to leave a work unit would be if staying meant having to be a party to presiding duplicity. To test the possibility, we constructed another experiment on university business students that was much like our first study. In that half of them were part of a team led by a leader who advanced its agenda through deception, and the other half were part of a team that did not act deceptively. Afterward, they were told that prior to beginning a second group task, they could elect either to stay with their team or to move to a different one. When we counted the votes, we found that 51% of those who had been in an ethical group decided to leave their team. But 80% of those in an unethical group chose to leave theirs. To gain confidence that these results applied beyond our laboratory setting, we turned to the data from our national survey of workers, which revealed clear turnover-related patterns. Not only were employees of unethically rated organizations more likely to feel stressed and more likely to want to quit, it was this stress that was pushing them to leave, and to leave their employers with financially draining turnover costs as a consequence. Strike two, we thought. Employee fraud and malfeasance. Notice that, according to our thinking, the flight of personnel from an ethically compromised company isn't expected to include everyone. Rather, because the exodus is launched by the stress from conflicting moral values, it will be specific to employees with high ethical standards. Those comfortable with the use of trickery to achieve financial gains should be happy to stay. And therein lies the source of our third specified tumor of organizational dishonesty. Phrased in terms of a caution to any leader responsible for shaping the ethical climate of an organization, it is as follows. Those who cheat for you will cheat against you. If you encourage the first form of deceit, you will get the second, which will cost you dearly in the bargain. Owing to the tendency for personnel to exit organizations where the ethical fit is poor, a company with an enduring culture of misconduct will push away many honest employees, leaving an accumulating precipitate of individuals disposed toward wrongdoing and who, when given the opportunity, will do their wrong to the firm. By our argument, then, such an enterprise will draw under its coat a viper, a snake whose bite will be fiscally venomous, as the costs of employee fraud and malfeasance are figured in trillions of dollars worldwide. What's more, these losses, stemming from embezzlement, theft of inventory or equipment, expense account inflation, falsified purchasing reports, and under-the-table deals with vendors or business partners, are rarely recouped. This argument seems a good one, with its proclaimed logic, major fiscal implications, poison-linked metaphorical flourish and all, but where's the evidence? To find it, we turned again to our experimental setting and one final procedure. Recall that in our second study, subjects became part of a work unit that either did or did not embrace dishonesty. And when we gave them the chance to stay with the unit or leave it for another, many more chose to quit their team if it had acted unethically. At this point, we told everyone that because of unforeseen logistical difficulties, we weren't able to accommodate any team switching. Therefore, they'd be working on the next task with their original teammates. Actually, the next task required them to work against those teammates to determine who could best solve an array of word problems quickly. Whoever did so within 1 minute would increase the probability of winning a $100 prize. Before participants provided their solutions, we arranged for them to accidentally see the answer key for the problems in an untraceable way. Through pretests, we had learned that, on average, the typical student at the university could solve 3.17 of the problems in a minute. So, by comparing participants' reported number of problems solved to the 3.17 standard, we could see which types of participants were likely to cheat to elevate their own economic interests over those of their colleagues. The results were clear. Among the participants who had been part of an honest work unit and had elected to stay in it, cheating was non-existent to negligible, which suggests a high five should be given to the many leaders who have had the integrity and organizational wisdom to establish an ethical culture. Participants choosing to leave either an honest or a dishonest work unit cheated somewhat, but not to a statistically significant degree. The big news, though, came from the actions of those who, when previously given the chance, had opted to remain in a dishonest environment. They cheated 77% more than the average of everyone else. That cheating, remember, didn't merely enhance their own financial prospects, but also undermine those of the people around them. It might be too harsh to label these actions venomous, but they did appear sufficiently toxic to justify a close look at our survey numbers to assess the related evidence from naturally occurring workplace experiences. We examined the relationships among items measuring employees' ratings of the ethicality of their workplace as set by its leaders, their desire to leave that workplace, and their admissions of malfeasance on the job, that is, economically harmful actions taken against their employers, such as altering expense reports, sabotaging equipment to avoid having to work, and using company resources for private purposes. The key finding was that employees in unethical organizations who preferred to remain in them were abnormally likely to engage in such deceitful, financially costly workplace activity. Just as in our laboratory experiment, individuals happy to reside in unethical workplace nests were revealed to be happy to foul those nests. Near the start of this book, I admitted that its completion was several years late, because a university administrator, using a persuasive tactic, got me to agree to teach an MBA course at his university while I was there on a leave of absence to write the book. The decision derailed those writing plans during my stay at his school. However, I also admitted to seeing certain positive outcomes of the decision, such as having a good story to tell about the power of persuasion and being able to include in the book recent research that wasn't available back then. There was another positive as well. I got the opportunity to ask students in the course, who had all returned to school after several years in the working world, to write an essay describing what they had experienced while being employed in an organization with either an ethical or unethical work climate. Most chose to report on what they'd felt and witnessed in an unethical culture, perhaps because those memories were more intense. One student provided an edifying account of a company he had worked for that started out healthy but had since suffered a $1 billion loss. The CEO abused the influence principles on a regular basis. He claimed scarcity when there was abundance. He used his authority to make others act against their better judgment and created examples of social proof that didn't exist. People believed him in the short run, but as the truth leaked out, the company's reputation deteriorated. Few companies are willing to do business with him now. Those that do will only do so on onerous terms. The culture of dishonesty trickled down throughout the organization. The marketing department was coerced to exaggerate the truth. The PR department wrote mostly false press releases, and salespeople coerced customers. Job dissatisfaction and turnover were incredibly high. People were attracted to the company by high salaries, which the CEO saw as justification for treating employees poorly, but left as soon as they could find work elsewhere. Taking a cue from the executives, employees would steal from the company whenever they could, usually via travel and expense reports. Some would cut side deals with suppliers. When I visited a few months ago, nearly half the staff had left, and morale was lower than ever. Strike 3? I am strongly inclined to hope so. Of course, whether that hope is ever realized depends on the extent to which leaders accept the financially based argument against duplicity and choose to act accordingly. The Tinkerbell scenario isn't going to apply here. Unless those leaders set the proper organizational tone, this argument won't take wing and fly just because the rest of us really, really believe in it. The concurrence of those at the top is required. Fortunately, if they want, they can build and maintain an ethically commendable workplace culture as readily as an ethically objectionable one. What could be done to send senior leaders more eagerly down the virtuous path? For one large group of them, no shift in direction seems necessary. They've already decided on that route and should be admired for following it. But for the nearly half who feel that economic considerations do warrant dishonest conduct, it may be necessary to lay out certain countervailing costs of employee underperformance, turnover, and malfeasance that apply, even when the misconduct is not detected by outsiders. as a set of general recommendations that all commercial organizations might want to adopt. Three appear worth the effort. Honesty ratings by customers and clients of employees they interact with should be part of the employees' incentive structures. In addition, the ethical reputation of the company as a whole should be measured and included in assessments of yearly performance. Finally, ratings by employees of the firm's ethical orientation should be a component of senior management's, and especially the CEO's, compensation package. The effect of these steps would not only incentivize ethical conduct, but also bring continuing, heightened attention to ethical standards. The consequent focused attention on these matters would, justifiably, elevate their perceived importance and causal role in organizational affairs. Chapter 14. Post-suasion. After effects. Throughout this book, we've seen that successful persuasion can occur when audience members' attention is channeled temporarily to a psychological concept favorable to a follow-on message. However, if persuasion is indeed based on temporarily directed attention, there's an important question all persuaders must confront. When rival communicators, or even everyday events, divert that attention to some other concept, what can be done to prevent the favorability from evaporating? It's a worthwhile concern, as change agents are usually interested in generating more than short-term movement, although, as prior chapters attest, time-limited shifts can be extraordinarily productive when managed astutely. Nonetheless, for optimal impact, the hope is to have an enduring effect. Two effective strategies are available, each arising from a different approach to social influence, one old school and one new school. Creating lasting change by installing strong commitments. Traditionally, behavioral scientists have offered a straightforward answer to the question of how to make a person's initially affirmative response persist. Arrange for the individual to make a commitment to that response, usually in the form of an active step. Consider how this recommendation can reduce a costly social problem. Patients who fail to appear for medical and dental appointments are more than an inconvenience. They represent a sizable expense to the healthcare system. A standard practice designed to reduce these no-shows involves calling patients the day before to remind them of the appointment. In a study led by my colleague Steve J. Martin and conducted in British medical clinics, such efforts reduced failures to appear by 3.5%. But the reminder calls required time and money to deliver and didn't always reach their targets. Compare that to the wisdom of employing a commitment procedure. When making a future appointment after an office visit, we all know what happens. The receptionist writes down the time and date of the next appointment on a card and gives it to patients. If instead the patients are asked to fill in the card, that active step gets them more committed to keeping the appointment. When this costless procedure was tried in the British Medical Clinic study, the subsequent no-show rate dropped by 18%. Although the effect of reducing missed medical appointments is no small thing, an 18% decline could net the equivalent of $180 million per year in the United Kingdom alone, it's possible that prompted behavioral commitments can have a much larger societal impact by influencing political elections. In 2008, shortly before the presidential election between Barack Obama and John McCain, Americans in several states were surveyed online regarding their political attitudes and beliefs. Half saw a small American flag at the top left corner of the survey questionnaire as they began to answer its questions. The other half saw no flag. exposure to the American flag in this subtle way caused participants to become more favorable to McCain's Republican Party and its politically conservative